Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. We talk about what's cooking in Central Iowa. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
And this is the kitchen. We have a lot of things that we talk about around our kitchen table. October. It's a good time for a clean out the garden soup. You'd be surprised what's out there yet. I made a great soup this weekend.
Moles.
Not moles. I didn't put any moles in my soup whatsoever.
Squirrels.
Although maybe I'll try that next week, Donna. Yes.
Gotta get that protein in there.
Anyway, there was lots of good stuff in that soup. And also, frost is coming if it hasn't already hit your garden. Time to move some plants inside. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market had a chili cook-off last Saturday. I went and tasted lots of good chili. It's time to get your pumpkins. Time to carve those pumpkins. Save and roast the seeds of those pumpkins. Don't throw the insides away. And take time to notice the fall colors. Some maple trees are really outdoing themselves this year.
Oh, it's starting to get beautiful.
Isn't it?
Finally.
Enjoy the beautiful weather.
Okay. Today we have a guest in the studio, Cornelia Flora, who is a distinguished professor emeritus from ISU and a research professor at Kansas State in rural sociology. Now, since we are a fairly rural community, Neil really knows what's going on around here. Her latest book is called Rural Communities, Legacy and Change, and she is here to talk about the World Food Prize and the Alternative World Food Prize, all of which happened last week. Neil, give us a little overview of what all these events are.
I will, but first I have a really important question for you. I find that cleaning the seeds to roast them takes a really long time. Do you have a trick to make this not an all-day project to roast your pumpkin seeds?
Oh, let's see. What do? I put them in warm water and slush them around for a while and rinse. But I don't mind a little slimy bit. But warm water in a sieve, it actually can be almost kind of hot water in a sieve.
It's true. Once they roast, all those little filaments kind of cook down. And, you know, you have to split the seed to eat them anyway.
Yeah. But warm water in a sieve under running hot water will help. Will help.
I have to say, I just throw my seeds out for the squirrels. I'm always feeding the squirrels.
Good.
Thank you. I mean, it's really good to be around good technical expertise. And when we're talking about technology transfer, and we're talking about what kind of technology will be useful in what settings.
We're all for low tech in the kitchen, right?
But it does make sense to understand who's going to use what and how. And so one of the things the World Food Prize has focused on, but not always focused on, is the notion of producing more.
Quantity.
We've got to have more, and the way you do more is to breed input-responsive crops and
animals. Input-responsive crops means?
And animals, which means that this...
You can goose them up in their productivity by chemical and not natural means.
Give them, it can be natural means, too. You can give them more water. You can give them more nitrogen. You can give them more selenium. You can give them more stuff, and they will produce more. So they're input responsive. Now, they will also grow where they don't have those inputs, but they will grow rather like any other one of these crops.
This is a purchased input response.
Again, it doesn't have to be purchase input response. It is.
Pardon my negativity.
You
here.
you can put on compost. You can put on manure. But it's how what it responds to. Now you can also have crops. So the reason the grain revolution was so wonderful, and Swaminathan explained this terrifically.
And Swaminathan
is an Indian scientist, agricultural scientist. He's an agronomist, but he also is a breeder and very far seeing. And he worked with Norman Borlaug. He respects him very much.
And he was speaking at ISU last week.
He spoke at ISU last week, but he also was a speaker at the World Food Prize.
Ah.
I have to tell you that I hear these speakers when they are not speaking at the World Food Prize because it costs $540 to go into the World Food Prize sessions themselves.
My.
And I'm emeritus.
Attending.
And I'm emeritus. But they have wonderful side events. So I went to some terrific events around soil. I did some very, very good event put on by USAID looking at how we need to change our model of higher education for science in Africa. So there are lots of good things going on that you don't have to pay $540 to attend. And Iowa State has done a brilliant job of getting, we had the recipient himself speak here, as often happens, as well as Swaminathan. Swaminathan is an Indian citizen. He is the one who established the notion of an evergreen revolution. And his view...
He's not just growing trees.
No. Evergreen means that it is sustainable. It means you maintain the soil. It means you maintain the people. And he understands sort of how change works. And he's particularly good at explaining why farmers count. He explained that the reason the Green Revolution took off in India, in the Punjab, was because of the Sikhs. The Sikhs were very entrepreneurial.
Very industrious.
Very industrious, who were absolutely ready for this technology. They're very well organized.
And this would be in the 50s and 60s we're talking about?
Yes.
Yes.
Particularly the 60s. And so they were well organized, so they had a policy in place that put in irrigation. Without irrigation, it would not work because the Punjab is a fairly dry area. You had access to fertilizers that the government helped subsidize. So this also helped. And one of the things Swaminathan puts out is profitability depends on policy.
All right. This is a major concept here. Can you talk a little bit about profitability determines?
No.
Policy determines profitability.
Yes.
Now, that applies to agriculture all over the world, particularly here in Iowa. So let's make the translation from India to Iowa.
Okay. I'll give sort of one of the things that policy determines.
As in, we're talking what happens with changes in the Farm Bill, for example.
Or the Farm Bill or others. It determines, for example, how much risk can you afford to take, which we are now supporting through both income insurance and insuring through yield insurance.
Right. This is what Iowa corn and soybean farmers rely on to make sure in case of crop failure.
And some argue that, therefore, planting corn and soybeans will always be profitable. In the past, before we had these policies, you avoided risk by being diverse. You grew diverse crops. You had diverse animal operations.
So that if one failed, the other would be fine.
And now we grow industrial inputs, and we do this in a way that as long as you plant it by a certain date, there are rules after all, it will be profitable. Now, this encourages risk-taking.
Absolutely, because you're guaranteed a price support by the government.
Now what they're trying to do with this is move this risk toward other risk protection to a wider variety of crops. But what it happens to do, since it's based on your past productivity or the productivity in your county, it means you do not experiment with new crops, new ways of doing things. Although I'm being amazed at how much farmers are still experimenting. One of the things that this does, and Swaminathan pointed this out well, it means when we're talking about feeding the world, which is a very arrogant way to talk, I think we ought to talk about the world feeding itself and how we can contribute to it, is that we focus on feeding the world with what crops? Corn, soybeans, wheat.
Well, the problem is most of the corn and soy that we produce, I wish I'd written down the percentages, but large percentages are actually don't go towards food. I mean, how much corn and soybeans can we eat?
Well, of course, this is why we have so many uses for corn and soybeans. Why
high
they
fructose
appear?
Corn syrup, corn plastics.
They appear in many of the products that we eat. But one of the things that Swaminathan and many others were talking about in these side sessions was how can we diversify the crops we support. And I was on...
From a policy point of view?
From a policy point of view.
Excellent.
How do we support research, for example, in crops that are outside of this huge corporate-driven value chain?
Yeah, monocropping systems there.
And the point is that we shouldn't expect... The private sector is very good at driving the monoculture value chain.
Absolutely. It's in their own best interest.
So, and Swaminathan made this point. So he said, what is it that public sector research should be supporting in terms of agriculture?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he suggested that it should be those crops in which there is no profit, particularly sort of where is profit made. Not that there's no profit to the farmer, but there is not that profit in the value chain. And we've all seen these graphs that show how much of the dollar for a particular crop
goes to the farmer. And Neil, do you think that if the farmer is willing to experiment with things where the profits don't accrue to the, well, to all the processors and all the input people, do you think the farmer has a better chance of capturing more of that food dollar then, perhaps?
Well, this is possible, but there's got to be a draw through. That is to say, if you're going to capture a food dollar as opposed to eat it yourself, you've got to have some sort of way to get that to a market.
Processing, transportation.
Somebody who will buy it and pay for it. Mm-hmm. So this is why a lot of agricultural research looks at value chains.
Distribution. Mm-hmm.
So distribution, and I saw something really interesting with organic production that when we were studying in Illinois, and the way they really wanted organic soybeans to sell to Japan. Organic soybeans must be raised through a very strict rotation. So it was fine to rotate with corn, but you can't do really organic with just a two-crop rotation.
No, organic requires a three-year crop rotation.
So they had to find a way of getting a market, and I believe it was barley was their other crop, or other small grains.
It's usually barley or wheat or oats
Until that was established, you really couldn't then move to that rotation. Because a lot of people are not really willing to say, well, you know, this is like canola is really good for my soil, but I'm not sure I really want to plow it under or just sort of let it go. So the notion is these ways of making commercial crops, even local commercial, depends on other institutions being in place that can
like milling, for example. Lost a lot of our infrastructure in the state is really only built for corn and soybeans. Like organic farmers really suffer to find ways to sell that third crop, even to get it to market. Like early morning harvest, Earl Hafner's mill that he built himself is a good example of what it's taken to overcome that. So he grows his own wheat. He mills it. He sells it. Cleans it. It's complicated.
Let me give you another example from a crop that I happen to be working on in Kansas, which is camelina, which is a small oil...
Camelina.
Camelina is a small oil seed that has oil, is actually quite healthy.
Camelina.
Camelina is the name of the...
C or K?
C.
C-A-M-O-L-I-N-A?
C-A-M-E-L-I-N-O-A, yes. Camelina. Sorry. And... They're This is public sector research in a very large measure supported by USDA. The Kansas State University Experiment Station is doing some very interesting camelina trials. They're particularly interested in what good things it can do for the soil.
Now, what is a camelina plant? Is it a cross between something else?
No, it is one of these many crops that we have
that we know nothing about.
We invented canola, or the Canadians invented canola, because they had to breed out the bad acids that damaged livers. So it used to be called rapeseed, mm-hmm. and they used to use the oil in paint thinners and things. But the Canadians varied it to be edible, and it's a marvelous edible oil at this point. Well, with camelina, it is a seed, just one of these oil seeds that's sort of been around. And it's interesting. No, actually, it can be a perennial.
Oh, and wow!
But you're still planting it. But it's the point is that weeds are a social construction. So for a long time, we thought this was a weed. Well, it turns out that somebody's weed is somebody else's food.
Dinner. Yeah.
And this, so what they're finding that particularly in Wyoming, farmers have put in their own presses. Their oil presses. This takes some investment, but it's not a huge industrial mm-hmm, thing. Mm-hmm. So they press out the oil. Some of them are there's some folks in Minnesota that are selling this on the internet.
Are they using it for food or fuel or both?
Food. Right this time, it's using it for food because they're to convert it to a fuel is a whole new. Now, some people are actually doing canola oil in small presses to fuel their diesel burning. Farm equipment. But the problem is, once you use your fuel that you grow yourself, you have negated your maintenance contract with the dealer who wants you to buy the established fuel because they're not sure what's going to be in that you're putting in there, and they don't want you screwing up the engine that they have guaranteed.
So unless your equipment is paid for, you can't do it.
Well, you're taking a risk. You're taking a risk. So
complicated.
Well, even if your equipment is paid for, you may have some sort of maintenance contract that you do not want to get rid of. But so they're selling this, the cake, the press, the meal that comes out of this, like soybean
out
meal.
Out of the camelina.
Out of the camelina because it's a seed. So you get the oil outside the seed, and then you get this press. It turns out to be a marvelous feed for animals.
Pigs, cattle?
Pigs and cattle and chickens.
Oh!
And they particularly like it for dairy cattle. Ah. So it's something that you need. But again, to do this, you then will need to actually sell it.
Infrastructure.
And you need USDA approval because, quite rightly, we have rules that say you can't just feed anything to animals that are going to interstate commerce. So these are very complicated and very interesting puzzles that only public sector research will address. I mean, that Monsanto is unlikely, not because they're evil, but just because there's no financial interest in working with camelina or some of these other.
It's not something they can patent unless they genetically modify it.
And so, well, that's one of the reasons. And it's long term. There's not any. I mean, you have to look at what are the crops that are genetically modified. They are the crops that people are already growing, so that you don't have to convince anybody to change what they grow.
Right. So there's
you simply have to change. You have
for
to make
it.
It's my colleague Steve Sapp would say, this is not a risky shift to move to GMO corn or soybeans because you're just doing what you're always doing, only more so. And in fact, you get all these packages that come together, so it was even easier than before. On the other hand, if you're going to raise canola or put on cover crops, this is a risky shift. This demands changing a whole lot about what you do.
So cover crops are still considered risky?
If you're a farmer, it means you're going to have to start doing things very differently than you did before. So what you're risking is your comfort level. You're risking what you know. Because you don't know exactly how this cover crop's going to turn out. Actually, when you plant anything, you don't know how it's going to turn out because you don't know what the weather will be. You don't know Or you don't know what prices will be unless you've forward contracted. So you have this notion of what does it take to make a risky shift? Well, again, farmers are, in generally, will try something out on a small scale and then move it forward. But they didn't need to do that when you're growing GMO corn, GMO canola, or GMO soybeans.
When they move from conventional to GMO
is really not a shift at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this value chain is set up so that germplasm arrives to the dealer who also conveniently sells what it takes to make it grow the best. And you just keep doing it. And turns out you can farm more acres with the same amount of equipment, with less labor. So this was not surprising, but this was quite brilliant of them to not say, now we're going to come in with a new oil seed or a new crop. We're just going to do it with what you're already doing. This is not an insidious plot. This is smart marketing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that if we understand sort of why do we have the GMO price, and then rice. And, of course, rice is very controverted yet. Wheat is, again, the GMO wheat is also controversial because it's often raised by smaller farmers. But when small farmers grow a crop, which is why countries like Mexico are hesitant to accept GMOs, because the reason this grows so well, again, because they're input responsive, and because these hybrid varieties are required to be purchased every year, and then you have to purchase the inputs every
year.
Well,
and this is just a little historical note. People used to, of course, save their best seeds every year and then plant that in the spring. So now, obviously, for farmers, of course, in Iowa, everyone's used to this, but the cost of the seed corn itself is another business expense. Whereas in countries like India, seed saving was historically very, very valuable.
Well, one of the things you have
and
to
the look- loss of that is a critical issue.
But we have to look at whether something is cross-pollinating or self-pollinating. Mm-hmm. For example, soybeans is self-pollinating, as is rice. Corn is not. Corn cross-pollinates. So you never know if you save a corn seed, if it will come out the same. Some seeds you save, you're saving your tomato seeds, you're pretty sure that's going to breed true because that's a self-pollinator. But if it demands cross-pollination, as do many crops,
squash is a cross-pollinator.
Then it is much easier to get very interesting. The same plant can yield a whole lot
but
of different things.
You don't get a consistent crop.
You don't get a consistent crop. So this is sort of another sort of piece of how do you decide which crops you're going to go with. Now, one of the things that was interesting, this was at the Iowa Hunger Summit, and also the very worthy prize winner from CAST for their communication award. CAST is the Council for Agricultural Science and Technology. I served on their board long ago, first as a representative of the Rural Sociological Society, and then I was elected by the general membership to serve on the executive committee. And it's an organization that tries to promote agricultural science and technology. And they gave their award to a marvelous woman at UC Davis who is actually from Australia, who is a animal scientist, does a lot of work with cloning, but came up through extension. So she's really interested in these issues and she's sort of arguing genetic GMOs are not in of themselves bad. Genetic technology is not in and of itself bad, which I agree with. But we see there can be some severely bad consequences. Now, one of the things sort of defense of GMOs kept saying is all those people who are against GMOs think they're going to poison you. Well, there are in fact, no really good studies that show that eating GMOs will have a negative impact on our health. There was a very faulty rat study from France that used no controls and actually did the study with tumor-prone rats. So that So we don't really know that eating this will hurt our health. But we do know if you put on lots of extra pesticides, it's very clear that if you're using pesticides to kill the weeds that are now evolved to be resistant to the pesticides your previous GMOs were designed to.
And it is clear that we are using more and more pesticides, contrary to what they initially told us about. They were saying we would need less pesticides. Well, we are now using far more pesticides than ever before, and likely to continue.
And this has been the concern. For example, in Uruguay, people they see the GMO corn and soybeans going in, and their concern is not that by eating these GMOs people will be sick, but applying the pesticides in. And what happens very often when you bring a new technology in is the notion that if some is good, more must be better. So it, particularly in countries where this is new, you just put on a lot of it. We did this when we first started spraying mosquitoes with DDT. The more you do, the better it must be. So you go to a park full of people eating lunch and spray everybody because it was safe. Well, it turns out it's not safe. It turns out it's still lingering in our environment. But the sort of this first euphoria often doesn't allow us to look at the long-term risks. But again, by saying that it's just people who stupidly think that GMOs will poison you by the seed itself, we're ignoring the concerns, the more subtle concerns around food sovereignty issues, which is, can people produce their own food that they can afford to produce and consume?
Yes, it seems that this GMO has just keep asking more and more questions. We're talking on the Donalana Kitchen with Cornelia Flora about GMOs, food policy, and lots of other things. I want to remind everyone that we are listening to KHOI Community Radio, and we're going to get right back to more questions.
Okay, so Cornelia Flora is a rural sociologist. She lives here in Ames, and she's quite an authority on things. You mentioned food sovereignty. I did want to make a clarification because you see these words used a lot, food sovereignty and food security, and there is a difference. Food sovereignty means that people are able to grow their own food. Food security means they have enough food, and it doesn't matter where the food comes from, like we could give it to you. So those are not the same thing. So food sovereignty, I think, is a very important thing for people to have, because if someone's giving you your food, they could take it away. It's also kind of like you can feed a man a fish or you can teach him to fish, that whole thing. Better to teach him to fish.
Let me add another thing, too. You can give a man a fish. You can teach a man to fish. But if you do that, you must give them access to the fishing hole.
And there must be fish in the fishing hole, right?
So I think we forget, we love knowledge. I do. I'm with the university, so of course I do. But it's more than just the knowledge, and it's more than just something to eat today. It is access to the means of producing over a long period of time. And that's, I think, what we're talking about with food sovereignty. It doesn't mean everybody's going to grow their own food. And it doesn't mean that there is not even international trade in food. But it does mean that as much as can be produced and consumed within a nation, because sovereignty has that connotation of a nation state, that we're really working so that we can basically take care of ourselves. And remember, I said profitability depends on policy. Well, we have a lot of international policies.
Mm-hmm. And more and more and more.
And WTO is now has axed the COOL registration. That's country of origin labeling for cattle.
Which means we cannot, as a country, write on the package the place where the meat was grown. So if you buy a package of hamburger at the Hy-Vee, it does not have to say, this came from Argentina, this came from Australia, oh no, this came from down the road. We don't know.
Right. So there are, even in agriculture, international policies that impact
More and
profitability.
More and more and more.
But they're also a series of national policies. And when, presumably, in democracies, when a nation state can make its own policies about its food system, there is more chance of farmers being profitable and consumers getting a healthy diet. So this is sort of part of the notion around food sovereignty. One of the early proponents of food sovereignty was in Brazil. That started with the landless movement. But Brazil has done fascinating things, particularly under ex-president Lula, which is continuing into the current under the current president, to make sure that there is healthy local food available to schools. So you have these incredible programs that were put in place. And what is so exciting
government is policy.
Government policies. And the World Food Prize recognized President Lula and awarded him that prize several years ago. So the World Food Prize is aware of and appreciates some of the folks working with food sovereignty. And one other person who did this is Heifer International, was also included, also won a World Food Prize. So there is this intersection of World Food Prize, food sovereignty. But there tends to be this movement into the notion of food security, which basically says that food should be available, affordable, and culturally appropriate. Now, that means that sourcing of food doesn't matter. And one of the things that makes food affordable is when someone dumps a lot of corn or soybeans or wheat into an economy where it is produced, calling it aid, and therefore ruins the local markets. But we can say, oh, yeah, but it was affordable and available. So part of the thing about food sovereignty is that we are all being encouraged to do that less. Our early food aid was, frankly, a wonderful way to get rid of farm surplus.
Mm-hmm.
And more, and we also use it as a mechanism through PL 480 to let NGOs, non-government organizations who are working in development.
What's PL 480?
It is a mechanism where the government buys the crop, ships it overseas on what we called American bottoms, which means U.S. shipping lines, mm-hmm. U.S. flag carriers, and then delivers the food to a country to be distributed in a variety of ways. One of the ways this used to happen, and still does a little bit, is through being given to NGOs who then sold it and used the money for their development programs. A number of voluntary nonprofit organizations working overseas, starting with Catholic Relief and now CARE, have decided, no, we're not going to do this because we don't think this is good for local farmers. So mm-hmm. they have very bravely turned down this amazing source of income, which is PL 480, which was this surplus food that the government used to own that was shipped over there. Mm-hmm. And now they say, no, we don't sell it because we care about food sovereignty. We want these people to be able to produce their own crops. And so often I have heard stories of when PL 480 food came in, and frankly, our corn is not that edible to the average person.
No, it's grown for animal food.
And so so getting that food was not seen as a great favor. So I think, and the U.S. government is coming around to saying this is not a good use mm-hmm. of taxpayers' dollars, and
well,
it doesn't
okay,
raise a lot of
now we rent. Can use all of that for ethanol and
that we don't
have. We found other ways to dump our excess production.
So we should really consider what the term aid is about. Who are we exactly aiding when with our commodities sent abroad?
Is it aid or is it manipulation?
Yeah. Yes, but we've been talking about this subject in regards to the World Food Prize that happened in Des Moines last week.
It happens every year, right?
Yeah. And you talked about some of the past winners of the food prize. Can you speak a little bit about who won the prize this year?
I can speak a little bit. He is a conventional wheat breeder. from Iran. It was difficult getting the visa, but he was
Iranian.
Here.
Oh.
And so, I mean, this is I believe, was a very interesting and important choice. Someone who had worked with Borlaug, so another wheat breeder. And so this was, I think, a very exciting choice. And, of course, someone from the area where wheat originated, the Fertile Crescent, mm-hmm. I think is also very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Let's take a little bit of a music break here. I want to remind you that this is the Don Alana Kitchen on KHOI Radio, community radio for the heart of Iowa. We're talking with Cornelia Flora about GMOs and food policy and how we think we are feeding the world, but maybe not. You have some interesting things to say about food aid. You mentioned that food aid in the past ended up seeming a whole lot like dumping our excess commodities on people that it didn't really aid all that much. But there are some new ways to do that. Can you speak about that, Cornelia?
One of the things at the Iowa Hunger Summit that was really exciting were some of the efforts that Iowa farmers are doing generally through faith-based communities to donate bushels of their produce, their corn, their soybeans generally. They donate it for international assistance, but that doesn't mean that produce is shipped overseas. It means it is sold for this particular charity, and then that money is then used in development assistance rather than simply here's our corn, which is a wonderful way. I think a large number, I cannot give you the exact numbers, but a large number of Iowa farmers are saying, you know, we do want to feed the world, and we understand it's not going to be directly through our corn and soybeans.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like what I understand of an organization like the Heifer Project, which concentrates on starting people farming themselves or keeping people farming themselves. So there are ways to do that.
Well, and both of you have mentioned the Heifer Project, Heifer International. Basically, it's a charity. You kind of buy a rabbit or a cow, and then that rabbit or cow, you send the money to Heifer International, and the rabbit or the cow or the chicken then goes to an appropriate family who will, I think they even have to breed more and then pass it on to someone else in their community.
Yes. And what is interesting is we started out shipping our cows, chickens, et cetera, overseas. But now we've figured out that our cows and chickens and pigs are input responsive.
Right.
And so now we are using the money in the country to buy the land races, as they're called, that are locally adapted. Animals that are locally adapted to that.
Programs in the country.
In the country themselves.
Excellent.
And this is hugely exciting. I remember long ago working in the Dominican Republic with a woman with a chicken project. And these were fantastic chickens. And they would have done wonderfully in Iowa. But they were getting sick. And she said, I can't afford antibiotics for my children, much less for my chickens. So it was getting that balance right. And I think what has to be admired is saying, you know, what seemed like such a good idea at the time, we'll just give people what we have, turns out not to be a really, really good idea.
It's a little
but
more
we've
complex.
Learned.
Yes.
But it's very complex, and I think when we've learned, it's been spectacular.
Yes, well, there is a whole thing, of course, about losing the genetic variety of different breeds as in animals as well as seeds, but that's a whole other program. I do want to mention, and I don't know, Neil and I haven't talked about this book, but right now I'm reading a book called Feeding Frenzy, which when I finish it, I will talk about more on the show, but it covers a lot of the issues that we've been talking about today. So if you're more interested, I would recommend picking up a copy of Feeding Frenzy, and we'll talk about it more on another show, because this is something I'm sure Neil and I and Lana could discuss for days and days and days and days, but we also need to talk about chestnuts today and pumpkins and a few other very local and timely interests that we have.
That's true. But first, before we talk about chestnuts, I want to mention that this radio station is a community radio station. We rely on volunteers. We rely on your input, on your ears to listen, and we rely on your money to keep us going. And there's going to be a fundraiser coming up beginning November 5th.
Online fundraising drive, I believe.
Anyway, people on this radio station will be talking at you, and we want to know how many of you are listening. So call in, pledge, send your cash to keep us going. We depend on your donations to keep the lights on
and keep us growing.
And keep us growing. We serve the Central Iowa community. This is your radio station. And like I often say, if you don't like what you hear on the radio,
make your own show.
Come into KHOI and make your own show.
I mean, a lot has gone into it in the last how many years? We've actually built the tower. We've built the station. It's pretty significant, and we have a lot of local community members to thank for their volunteers, for their donations. So now that we got it up and running, we want to keep it going.
Right. And here's something to sort of whet your appetite. A gauntlet has been thrown down. We were talking about how to raise money, and it was mentioned that in some past fundraisers, a very generous donation of a carrot cake was made by the cafe, and everybody loves the cafe's carrot cake. Donna piped up and said, "Not so," she says. I have a carrot cake.
I have a better carrot cake.
So this is for the fundraiser coming up after the election. After the election, we're going to go into the KHOA fundraiser on November 5th. There will be the Donna's Carrot Cake Challenge.
Yes.
So stay tuned for that.
Just a little hint. I have to say why mine is better. Because the frosting, unlike the frosting of most conventional carrot cakes, my frosting is made with mascarpone cheese and dulce de leche, which is a South American kind of caramel sauce. And you'll have to win it to believe it. It's very good. And this will be won by the lucky person who makes some sort of significant donation, and details to be disclosed in the future.
And yeah, for those of you who want a sociological input, carrot cake counts as a vegetable.
Oh,
yeah.
See? That's the definitive
statement. Especially when the carrots will come from Gary Guthrie, the Carrot King.
That's wonderful. Oh, chestnuts, Donna.
Oh, yes, the local chestnuts are in the market now. I happen to love chestnuts. You know, a number of years ago, sort of in my youth, we had the chestnut blight, and it was no more. Who wrote the poem, "Under the Budding Chestnut Tree, the Village
Longfellow.
Smithy"?
Longfellow.
It's a very American nut. So somehow during our mid to late youth, we had a blight, and we lost all of the chestnuts. So they kind of went out of popularity. Now they've been breeding and planting long enough that we have a new chestnut variety. I think they bred them with Asian chestnuts or something.
See,
but
here's another example of we have been breeding and changing genetics.
Absolutely.
And growing things
and
for years and years.
Necessarily.
And here comes the chestnuts.
Save the chestnuts.
Yeah.
So what I do really is my favorite thing is roasted, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Anyway, or in your oven, as a matter of fact. So to roast chestnuts, you simply turn the oven on at about 350. You have to crack them a little bit. So I like take a knife and kind of lean on them. You don't cut it all the way through, but you just crack them enough because otherwise they will explode because they are moist on the inside.
So if you take a knife leaning on them, do you put the knife flat or do you take the point of the knife to lean on them?
Well, you kind of have to put it on the sharp edge and lean on them. And some people really bother to make an X, but that's far too tedious for me. I just put a hole in them, kind of a slice. Then you put them in. I just put them in a cast iron skillet or any pan. And depending on the size of the chestnut, you cook them maybe, roast them maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Too much and they're too dry and crunchy. So usually what I periodically pull one out and open it up. And if it's soft, like a potato kind of, not quite as soft as a potato, but soft enough to be, you know, chewy and mealy in the mouth, then they're ready. Then you just take them out and, you know, throw them on the table and everybody peels their chestnuts. The other use for chestnuts and is, of course, they can be dried and ground into flour. They can be candied. You can buy them as chestnut paste. I actually, when we get closer to Christmas, I used to buy them pre-cooked in the bottle because it's really tedious to peel them and then use them. By the time I peel them, I sort of pop them in my mouth. You know, it's kind of like picking berries. I'm not a very good berry picker because I just eat as I go. So I do make a chocolate truffle with chestnuts because it's much I developed this for my celebrity clients who were, you know, didn't want to eat much fat because chestnuts are very low in fat. But they have a wonderful consistency, so you can eliminate the butter in a truffle and just mix melted chocolate with the cooked roasted chestnuts and have a wonderful low-fat truffle. What a concept. Chocolate truffle, that is. So chestnuts are in. Please enjoy, as I have been.
And chestnuts are very seasonal. They do not last long.
Oh, yeah. You, this is fortunate, unless you get them in the jar, of course.
There we
you
go.
Can eat them all year round.
There you go.
So it's chestnut time.
Another fall thing here. I have a poem to read. It's harvest time. It's October. We see farmers out in the field. Iowa gets very bare looking this time of year. The corn goes away and the soybeans go away. Big fields are left to us. This is a poem by a poet named Thomas Allen Orr. It's about the soybean harvest in October. Soybeans by Thomas Allen Orr. The October air was warm and musky, blowing over brown fields heavy with fragrance of freshly combined beans, the breath of harvest. He was pulling a truckload onto the scales at the elevator near this rail siding north of town when a big Cadillac drove up. A man stepped out wearing a three-piece suit and a gold pinky ring. The man said he had just invested $100,000 in soybeans and wanted to see what they looked like. The farmer stared at the man and was quiet, reaching for the tobacco in the rear pocket of his jeans where he wore his only ring, a threadbare circle rubbed raw by working cans of dip and long hours on the backside of a 100-acre run. He scooped up a handful of small white beans, the pearls of the prairie, saying, "Soybeans look like a foot of water on the field in April when you're ready to plant and can't get in. Like three kids at the kitchen table eating macaroni and cheese 5 nights in a row. Or like a broken part on the combine when your credit with the implement dealer is nearly tapped. Soybeans look like a prayer bouncing off the ceiling when prices on the Chicago grain market start to drop. Or like your old man's tears when you tell him how much the land might bring for subdivisions. Soybeans look like the first good night's sleep in weeks when you unload at the elevator and the kids get Christmas." He spat a little juice on the tire of the Cadillac, laughing despite himself and saying to the man, "Now, maybe you can tell me what $100,000 looks like."
That was a good poem for an October soybean harvest by Thomas Allen Orr. It's October. There's potlucks that go on all the time, but these late-season harvest potlucks, you want to make something special. And I occasionally bake. Yes, I occasionally do. What I usually take to a potluck, or have been taking recently, is my favorite recipe for blonde brownies. Easy, blonde brownies. I got this recipe from my sister-in-law, Jane. Everyone should have a sister-in-law, Jane. These blonde brownies are quick to make. They're kind of like chocolate chip cookies in a pan.
I had some the other night. They're fabulous.
They're pretty good. And Donna often talks about the tyranny of the recipe. I'll give you this quick recipe, and it will be posted on our website, on the KHOI website. You can go to the Donna Lana Kitchen page.
I'm sorry, but baking really does need a recipe. You know, if you stray too far with the baking powder and things like that, you could have it could be a disaster.
So here goes. 2/3 cup sifted flour, 2 1/2 teaspoons baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 2/3 cup butter or shortening. Melt and cool the butter and shortening. 2 1/4 cup, 1 pound of brown sugar. I'd cut back on that. 3 eggs. Beat those eggs in one at a time to the butter and sugar. And then mix that with the flour, baking powder, and salt. 1 cup chopped nuts and 1 package chocolate chips. Put that in a greased 15 by 10 pan. Bake it for about 30 minutes in a 350 oven. And there you have blonde brownies. And they seem to go pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think I ate 3 the other night, I'm embarrassed to say.
They were small. They were small.
I was comparing it to a similar recipe I use, which is from The Joy of Cooking, and she calls them butterscotch brownies. So I have to say, just look it up. It's a really common recipe. It's fairly similar. It's butter, brown sugar, egg, vanilla, flour, baking powder, salt. Now, what I add to that that's not in The Joy of Cooking is I use a lot of pecans in it, and I add coriander, ground coriander seed. So that between the coriander and the pecans, it makes it taste kind of like a New Orleans pecan praline.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
So look for that as your favorite potluck if we're there, or make it yourself. That sounds really good. So I want to remind folks of the KHOI fundraiser that's coming up. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctico.
Donna Prisgintas.
And thanks to our special guest, Cornelia Flora. We had a fine discussion around our kitchen table. You've been hearing the music of the Barn Owl Band. I want to remind folks there's a barn dance this weekend. Live music, lively caller, lots of fun. That's Saturday, October 25th. We had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Go to the Donna Lana Kitchen on the KHOR website and find past shows, find recipes, support KHOI. Stay tuned for the great carrot cake challenge. Eat good food, enjoy life.